I'm Jessica Harris. This is From Scratch. My guest is Neil Blumenthal, the co-founder of Warby Parker, an online eyeglass retailer that sells vintage-inspired glasses for $95. For each pair of glasses sold, Warby Parker provides a pair of glasses to low-income people in more than 36 countries. Neil co-founded the company in February 2010 with three other classmates from Wharton Business School. Welcome.
Thanks for having me.
So before we get into the details of the company, I'd like for you to walk me through the current landscape of the optical industry. What does it look like?
So right now, typically, one walks into an optical shop, they bring a prescription, and they spend several hundred dollars on a pair of glasses. My co-founder, right before we launched, he actually had spent $700 on a pair of glasses and had forgotten them in an airplane and just couldn't justify spending $700 again to replace them while he was a full-time graduate student. So when we look at the industry, we see that it's dominated by one company in particular. It's a publicly traded company called Luxottica. They do about $1 billion, $8 billion a year in revenue. They're vertically integrated. They've outright acquired Oakley, Ray-Ban, Oliver Peoples, Persol, and Arnett. They license all the major fashion brands, Ralph Lauren, Chanel, Prada, you name it. They then have systematically bought up all of the retail chains. So they own LensCrafters, Pearle Vision, Sunglass Hut, Sears Optical, and Target Optical. And then the icing on the cake is they own the second largest vision insurance plan in the country, iMed, that also major health plans like Aetna use as their vision plan. So typically, if you were to go into a LensCrafters, you might see 40 different brands of glasses. They're all designed by the same people, manufactured in the same factories, and you might pay for that pair of glasses with your vision insurance, and it's all owned by one company.
Are there any antitrust issues that have come up? Why isn't there more antitrust legislation surrounding them?
Yeah, I'm not a sort of an expert on monopolies, but I know that there was some attention sort of given by sort of the FTC and the Justice Department when they were acquiring Sunglass Hut, when the Justice Department was looking at sort of the number of retail outlets that sell glasses. They were including pharmacies that sell like over-the-counter reading glasses and sunglasses, and when you include those sort of outlets, you know, there are thousands of them, right? Luxottica only has a small percent.
Now, you're wearing Warby Parker glasses. You don't brand your glasses. There's Warby Parker on the inside. Why did you make that decision?
We think that glasses are a reflection of one's personality, and one of our core values is to treat others the way that we want to be treated. And when we were thinking about what glasses we wanted to wear, we didn't want to be a walking billboard for another company, right? We want to be walking billboards of ourselves. Mm-hmm. And then we actually did a bunch of research. At the time, we were at Wharton. We had 800 classmates, so we would just hit them with survey after survey after survey, and we found that overwhelmingly, yeah, people didn't want an external logo, and especially when you looked at people that had worked in the creative space, those people were even vehemently against having sort of external branding, and those are the folks that tend to dictate what's cool and are the early adopters, so we really wanted to take them into consideration when we were designing our first collection.
Prior to starting Warby Parker, you were a director at VisionSpring, which is a nonprofit organization founded by optometrist Dr. Jordan Casalow, and their purpose is to also provide low-cost glasses to low-income populations. What were you doing for them?
So I was running all of their operations and programs. So I worked on the pilot program down in El Salvador, basically sort of wrote the manual for how do you train low-income men and women in the developing world to start their own businesses, giving eye exams and selling glasses in their communities. Expanded the program to 10 different countries, started to design glasses for people living on less than $4 a day, and then going to Asia to manufacture them.
VisionSpring has something called a mobile unit. Can you describe that briefly?
There are hundreds of millions of people that don't have access to glasses. And what that means is that generally there aren't people in those communities giving eye exams and selling glasses. So the question is, how do you reach them, especially in like rural India? So VisionSpring innovated and came up with this idea to take a van, packed with people that could do a refraction and glasses and lenses, and would literally sort of set up almost like a soup kitchen for glasses, and you know, make announcements, and people would line up. They come, they get their eyes checked. If they need a pair of glasses, they can buy them on the spot, often for just a few dollars. So even people that are living on less than $4 a day can afford it. And when someone's paying for something, they value it. They're going to use it. You're treating them with dignity because they have the power to decide whether they want that pair of glasses or not. And we found that a simple pair of reading glasses, for example, would increase someone's productivity 35% and their income by 20%.
Now, just as you empower people inherently by forcing them to buy the glasses rather than giving them the glasses, you also allow them choice in, you know, the style of glasses that they wear, which is almost equally important to them. What were your findings there?
At Vision Spring, we had a saying that Jordan coined, that vanity is not monopolized by the rich. People would really rather be blind than wear a pair of donated 1970s cat eyes. And it's because they'll be ridiculed by their friends and neighbors, because ultimately glasses are a reflection of who you are, and fashion matters no matter where you live in the world. So when I was thinking about starting Warby Parker with a few friends, right, those lessons from serving people living on less than $4 a day were exactly the same, right? Glasses, while they have amazing sort of health function, they're ultimately fashion accessories.
You happen to wear eyeglasses. How long have you worn glasses?
So that's the funny thing, is that I really wear glasses as a fashion accessory.
Do you have a prescription in your lenses right now, or are they completely clear?
They're completely clear.
Ooh.
But they are UV protected.
Now, you grew up in New York City. Your mother was a nurse, and your dad was a tax lawyer, a partner at PricewaterhouseCoopers. What were some odd jobs that you had growing up in New York City?
Well, it was funny. I think my first entrepreneurial experience, I got sucked into one of those direct response TV ads for a food dehydrator, and begged my parents that I could spend $60 on a food dehydrator so that way I could make dried fruit and beef jerky. And all it was a couple plastic trays, a heat coil, and a fan. And what you do is you basically take like grapes, you put it in there for 3 days, and then you get raisins. It ends up being more expensive to try and make them yourself. But my bright idea was to have a food stand on like Mercer Street to sell dried fruit and beef jerky to New Yorkers.
So this was in high school. And you went to Friends Seminary, which is a Quaker high school in New York City, which has a real community focus. What impact do you think that your school had on you, if any?
I think it had a tremendous impact. You know, one of the things that was just core to the curriculum there was community service. Our school and our gym would actually turn into sort of a homeless shelter almost every evening. So if you were there late after school, you know, you'd see it and you'd actually help clean up to prepare for people that were coming in to spend the night.
I'm Jessica Harris. You're listening to From Scratch. My guest is Neil Blumenthal, co-founder of Warby Parker, a company that sells vintage-inspired glasses. For each pair of glasses sold, Warby Parker gives a pair of glasses to low-income populations internationally through nonprofit partners like Vision Spring. So fast forward to Wharton. You had three friends whom you co-founded the company with. And as you explained before, you had, you know, your classmates as focus groups. What other types of, you know, helpful information did they give you?
Well, an example was, we were trying to build this great brand, and we were trying to figure out, how do we name it? It actually was the hardest thing that we did. It took us 6 months. We came up with over 2,000 different names. Finally, we were really inspired by some early writings of Jack Kerouac, and two characters in particular, Warby Pepper and Zag Parker, and we thought that we had something here. So we immediately put together a survey, blasted it out to about 1,600 people, because at Wharton there's 800 people per class, and the results were amazing. First, we asked, you know, what is your gut reaction, sort of negative, neutral, or positive? Overwhelmingly, it was positive. And then it was, what are your sort of associations? And for the most part, people didn't have any associations. So you have this blank canvas from which to work. Mm-hmm. There were a few people that said Warburg Pincus, but we figured, you know, it was a Wharton population, a little focused on finance.
One of your co-founders and co-CEOs, David Gilboa had attended an exhibit at the New York Public Library of Jack Kerouac, which was the catalyst for the idea, right?
Absolutely. We had, you know, when we looked at folks that inspired us, we often looked at literary figures because of the tie between vision and reading. So we took a lot of inspiration aesthetically from our grandparents that went to work in the 40s and 50s, and then sort of the social ethos of our parents that, you know, were coming of age in the 60s and were reading sort of Kerouac and Ginsberg and others.
Incidentally, one of your first marketing presentations was this hush mob at the New York Public Library. Explain that incident.
We were trying to figure out what do we want to do for our fashion presentation, our first time that we were sort of in the scene and during Fashion Week. And what we decided to do was a guerrilla presentation at the New York Public Library. So we took about 30 models, put them in hair and makeup at the Bryant Park Hotel about a block away, snuck them in one by one. We had a couple employees sort of stake out about six tables in the great reading room. And then we had 25 fashion editors come and meet us. We had sent them these letterpress invitations with these vellum reading lists and little library cards. And we said, shh, meet us on 42nd and 5th Avenue in front of the building with the stone lions on it, because we didn't want to say the New York Public Library because we didn't really have permission. And we brought them in, and at 3:30 on the dot, all of the models put on their glasses and then lifted up these books with these bright blue book covers on it with the frame name by Warby Parker. And it just created this amazing visual, this very different sort of fashion show.
Now, the press has been a friend of yours from the beginning. You know, the first few weeks of your launch, you were in GQ and Vogue and Daily Candy. How have you had this love affair with the press? Like, is there one company or one person who really helped to push that forward?
I always say that sort of PR is about 70% messages, 30% the messenger. So we've been trying to be very deliberate in thinking about what is interesting for people to report on, and then, of course, get the right messengers. So we, in sort of when we were launching the company, there was only three things we invested in: our first collection, the website, and PR, knowing that you only have one shot to launch a lifestyle brand. And we just leveraged every personal connection possible. I mean, my wife, Rachel, has a contemporary jewelry line called Rachel Lee, and she used to work in PR at Yves Saint Laurent, so we really leveraged a bunch of her relationships.
I'm Jessica Harris. You're listening to From Scratch. My guest is Neil Blumenthal, co-founder of Warby Parker. We'll hear more from Neil coming up. I'm Jessica Harris. This is From Scratch. My guest is Neil Blumenthal, the co-founder of Warby Parker, a company that sells vintage-inspired glasses. For each pair of glasses sold, Warby Parker gives a pair of glasses to low-income populations internationally through nonprofit partners like VisionSpring. Incidentally, when you were at VisionSpring, you actually rebranded the organization. It used to be called the Skojo Foundation. How did that change in marketing and just branding impact what you carried over to Warby Parker?
Well, when I was at VisionSpring and we were working on the rebranding, we worked with this amazing creative group called What If, and we went through all these different exercises that I remembered that then when Jeff, Andy, Dave, and I were thinking about the brand architecture for Warby Parker that we went through. So an example would be, what are you and what aren't you? So an example would be, Warby Parker is collegiate, but we're not preppy. And getting into those very specific nuances is really the essence of a brand, thinking about what type of, if we were a car, what type of car we'd be. If we were a jeans company, what type of jeans would we be? Thinking about different reference images. So one image that we kept coming back to was the blue-footed booby. And, you know, I can't say it without laughing, and that was one of the reasons why we loved it, because who doesn't love a booby?
What is a booby?
It's this great sort of penguin-like bird that's found in the Galapagos. So for one thing, you kind of need to be knowledgeable and worldly to even know it exists. Because it kind of looks like a penguin, it's sort of sharp and sophisticated and has like a tuxedo. But then when you pan down, you see it has these bright blue webbed feet. So it's got this sort of unexpected sort of pop to it. And then when you look at its face, almost all these photos of the blue-footed booby, it has this sort of quizzical, comical look on its face that's very curious. Hmm. And that's also sort of part of who we are.
Just the name, blue-footed booby, like if it were called anything more serious.
It wouldn't work.
You co-founded the company with three of your classmates, which can be kind of risky, starting a company with your friends. But you kind of had this pact early on of staying friends no matter what. And what were some concrete things that you put in place to ensure that?
Yeah, it's funny. I vividly remember that first night that we decided to move forward. We were sitting at a bar and we basically promised each other two things. One was that we were going to work really hard, and the second that we were going to remain friends throughout the process. And we knew that there had been so many really smart people that had made similar pledges but weren't able to keep them. So we thought, what could we do, you know, systematically to sort of maintain these friendships and maintain a healthy working dynamic? And we created monthly 360 reviews where we'd go back to the same bar. The four of us would sit there. One person would be in the hot seat at a time, and we'd say, hey, you're doing this well. Hey, this can be improved. Hey, when you shoot me a 10-page email at 2 in the morning, I want to kill you. And it really helped any sort of issues to surface immediately and for us to resolve it and for us to just become, you know, a high-functioning team.
You had 360 reviews monthly. What were some issues that your partners had with you?
I think sometimes I'm known for immediately jumping into action and maybe not thinking things through as much as my three other co-founders. So sometimes it's, hey, Neil, slow it down a bit.
And does your wife say the same thing?
Sometimes, definitely. I tend to plan trips and then not really pack for them.
Now, David Gilboa, incidentally, in addition to being one of the co-founders and the co-CEO, he's also the fastest marathon runner who has run in a flamingo costume. And he's hiked across Antarctica.
Indeed, one of our core values is to inject fun and quirkiness into everything that we do. So we take Halloween very seriously. Every year, we decorate the office for a week, and we have everybody dress up and come to the office in full costume on a day that's not Halloween. So it makes for some pretty awkward subway rides.
What have you been?
Last year, I was Annie. Little Orphan Annie. And it was a little awkward. We had about 15 MIT students visiting that day, and I was giving a talk to them in this really small skirt.
Did you sing?
I didn't sing, but I'm hoping that it was memorable.
The four founders worked together as equal partners since inception and while you were still at Wharton. And then upon graduation in spring 2010, you and David Gilboa became co-CEO. Why do you think that was necessary?
You know, I think it would have been weird to have a reporting relationship between the two of us, regardless of who was going to be a superior and who was going to be the subordinate. And I think the other thing is that our skill sets complemented each other pretty well, so we were able to do it in an organized fashion. So we sort of split the business up into about 12 different departments, 6 roll up into me, 6 roll up into Dave. Ultimately, we have created mechanisms in case there is a disagreement. You know, for one thing, we each have the final say in our areas of responsibility, and then we, you know, work closely with our board on sort of major strategic issues.
Since it's still a private company, you could do whatever you want, until...
Yeah, until we have activist shareholders.
Okay. In the early days, when you launched, to your surprise, orders vastly outpaced your inventory. How did you respond to that imbalance?
Yeah, you know, we went from this moment where it was like, oh my God, our idea is actually working, to, oh crap, we're not going to be able to serve our customers. And the whole idea was to provide access, right? And within 48 hours, we had to shut down our home try-on program. Within 3 weeks, we hit our first year sales targets. Within 4 weeks, sold out of our top 15 styles. So we immediately had to just come out and sort of tell our customers, hey, we're really sorry. You know, we didn't expect there to be this much of a response. We're going to do everything possible to sort of get more inventory faster, but we're not going to take your credit card just now, and we're not going to charge you.
you took out loans from the bank shortly thereafter. How much capital did you have in those early days?
So we, the four of us, invested our life savings in the company. It was under $150,000. And then we ended up getting a $200,000 term loan that was backed by the Small Business Administration. That was difficult to get. Took us about 14 banks, even though every loan officer we saw said, wow, you know, this is really impressive business plan. You have all this traction. Our hands are tied. We can't make loans to companies that haven't been around for at least 2 years and have 2 years of tax returns. And this was coming off the heels of the 2008 financial crisis, where a lot of banks had to quickly implement measures to sort of rein in lending. We ended up leveraging a personal relationship. One thing that was interesting was that we had to put up $100,000 of our own capital to secure this $200,000 loan, even though it was backed up to 90% by the federal government. And that was because the bank said, listen, at the end of the day, if you don't pay, it's too much of a headache to try and get the federal government to reimburse us. Mm-hmm. Which was a little upsetting, knowing just I think that the SBA is a great thing, but just how can we sort of streamline it to make sure that's functioning as it should.
Did you also raise capital from friends and family? No venture, right?
At that point, no. It was about 18 months after we launched that we did our first equity raise, and that we had a mix of friends and family, of angel funds, and then actually individuals from the fashion and entertainment worlds. So people like Ashton Kutcher, Ari Emanuel, the CEO of William Morris Endeavor, Joel Horowitz, the former CEO and co-founder of Tommy Hilfiger, the family that owns Chanel. We really wanted sort of a diverse group that could help us build the next great lifestyle brand.
Now, you also looked at Zappos as some type of inspiration for you, the shoe company now owned by Amazon. What are one or two examples of that?
From day one, it was, how do we make buying glasses as easy as possible? So it's free shipping, free returns, hiring really talented people to sort of work in customer service and actually be in sort of like a call center. People think that it's crazy that we're managing sort of a call center in the middle of Soho using sort of graduates from top universities. But we're finding that they're able to deliver amazing customer experience, and this is a great marketing tool. When we measure customer satisfaction using Net Promoter Score, our score is a 91, which is higher than Apple and Zappos, and it ends up being a great sort of recruiting tool and a feeder to all of our other departments.
What has surprised you about the company? Like, what has been harder for you than you thought?
I don't know if we fully appreciated the technological challenges of sort of building a technology-enabled brand and somebody that sells primarily through e-commerce. So the four of us that started the company aren't technical, and it took us a while to sort of hire engineers, software engineers, developers, coders. There's actually a real sort of lack of engineering talent in the U.S. right now. It's limiting our growth, and it's limiting our ability to hire in other areas because we just don't have enough technical talent.
I'm Jessica Harris. You're listening to From Scratch. My guest is Neil Blumenthal, the co-founder of Warby Parker, a company that sells vintage-inspired glasses. The company has a home try-on option where it will send you five glasses that you choose on the website to try on at home for free. Incidentally, we were talking about Luxottica and, you know, just how the industry is controlled really by one or two companies. You are a David in comparison to this Goliath, but have you had any communication with them? Have they paid any attention to you?
Yeah, we had a brief conversation with them. I think it was almost a year ago or so. It was funny. We were meeting at their offices, and Dave and I told our team, if we're not back in 2 hours, call the cops. But no, it was a very open dialogue, sort of, you know, wondering if there's an opportunity for us to work together. You know, I have a lot of respect for the business that they've built, and I think that they're always sort of looking at, hey, what are some companies in the eyewear industry that are doing interesting things?
You're primarily an online company, though your face-to-face encounters with customers have been pretty important for the growth of the company. And in a way, you're marrying e-commerce with bricks and mortar. Can you describe that dichotomy a little bit?
So what we found was that when we were working out of our apartments in Philadelphia while we were full-time students and we had run out of a bunch of inventory, people started calling us and saying, hey, I heard you're in Philadelphia. Can we come to your office? And we'd say, you can come to my apartment. And people would show up. I remember the first person was a resident, and he came in with his scrubs, and we laid out the glasses on the dining room table, tried to make the apartment look as nice as possible. And we thought it was going to be this really suboptimal experience, but figured, what the hell, you know, we'll give it a shot. And it ended up being a really special experience because for the customer, they got a chance to meet the people behind the brand, which is so rare these days. And this particular person went on to be one of our biggest advocates. So when we moved back to New York and we set up our office, we made sure to make sure that our first office was in Union Square, that was easily accessible by subway, that it was southern facing and had light coming in. And we had a small showroom to the point where people just started coming in, and we got into huge fights with our landlord because they're like, you can't be running a store out of here. This is a commercial space. This is, should be an office. And the elevator broke, and it was a big disaster. Now we've since moved to the Puck Building on House and Lafayette, where on the fifth floor, we have a 600-square-foot showroom. Last month, we did over $250,000 worth of sales. When you look at it on a sales per square foot basis, right, that's approaching levels of Tiffany's and Apple, which, you know, it's crazy when you think about we're selling a $95 pair of glasses, you know, on the fifth floor of a non-retail building.
When you first launched the company, you were out of your apartments in Pennsylvania and you moved to New York. You then used your wife's office as the Warby Parker headquarters. How was that?
It was funny. We were all scrunched into sort of the back of her office, which was right in the Fashion District on 38th Street. And it was the summer, and it was just so hot. And her air conditioning units were positioned towards the front. So the first thing that we had to do was buy a fan. And then sometimes customers would come into the office, and, you know, you talk about being confused, right? It's an office building. The name on the door says Rachel Lee, not Warby Parker. And then you have to go to the back of the office to try on glasses. And you see all these people huddled around on laptops.
I want to go back to the partnership with VisionSpring. What are some stories or, you know, memories that you have of individuals whom you've helped, whether it was in El Salvador or India?
So I was recently in India, and I met a carpenter. And this was a carpenter who sort of had sort of the biggest wood shop in the neighborhood and made sort of beautiful furniture, pretty ornate. And his business started to suffer basically over the last couple of years as he was having trouble seeing. And he started to basically have to outsource the sort of the most value-add work. And, you know, All that he needed was a simple pair of over-the-counter reading glasses. So when VisionSpring visited his town, he was able to sort of buy those glasses. And literally within a few days, his business was back up to where it was a few years previously. And it's just, you know, there's story after story about that. I can't tell you how many times I've walked into a town that might be like a weaving community, and I'll sit in front of like 20 women and I'll ask them, who has trouble seeing? And nobody will raise their hand. And then I'll say, well, who has trouble threading a needle? And everybody will raise their hand. So often we had to link sort of activities to vision and sort of prove that, hey, glasses are sort of the solution here.
Anything else?
Yeah. One of the other things is sort of how do you market to people living on less than $4 a day in these communities? You know, we sometimes get crazy questions like, oh, when does the medicine run out when we're talking about glasses? One of the other things that we'd find is that early on, we learned that you need to build up credibility for the people that we're training over time, because we're training people from these communities where they've sort of grown up and gone to school with their neighbors over their entire lifetime, for them to sort of come back after a couple days training and say, hey, I can give eye exams and sell glasses, it's just outside of the realm of believability. So we had to create posters that said, you know, like vision entrepreneur in training. And give people sort of lab coats and ID cards and certificates of training so that way they could sort of prove to their friends and family that, hey, they had gone through this rigorous training. They do have the capacity to, you know, give these eye exams and sell glasses.
pretty universal.
Absolutely.
Your wife is a jewelry designer. What impact, if any, did she have aesthetically on the brand or on the glasses?
So there pretty much isn't a pair of glasses that we design that she doesn't sort of give an opinion on. I think we do follow her opinions almost all the time. So it's great to have sort of another person with a great aesthetic for us to sort of turn to. She has a great glasses face, and almost any pair of glasses sort of looks good on her. So we're able to always throw on different glasses on her to see if, you know, if we think it's going to work.
I know what you mean when you say she has a great glasses face. Some people wear glasses well, and others just doesn't work.
Yeah,
kind of like caps. You know,
yeah.
Some guys can handle caps, baseball caps, and others just, you know, keep it off.
As like Matt Lauer,
the host of the Today Show.
He was an eyeglass model for a while.
Huh.
And what was pretty neat was when we were on the Today Show, he was basically, every pair of glasses looked great on him. He even played with our monocle. And monocles even looked good on Matt Lauer.
Since you're so focused on the face and on eyeglasses in particular, really for the last decade, do you notice yourself, you know, recognizing things or noticing details that you might not have otherwise prior?
I think my wife yells at me for looking in the mirror for too long, but no, I can't walk down the street without staring people down if they're wearing eyeglasses or sunglasses, and to the point where they probably think, who is this weirdo staring at me?
Are you trying to figure out, are those my glasses, or what are you looking at?
Well, that's generally easy to do, and I remember the first time that I saw somebody wearing our glasses, it was at the Union Square train station. This gentleman was on the platform, and he sort of walked by me, and I kind of like was following with him, and he was kind of looking back like, who's this weirdo? Is he going to push me off the platform? But no, I just wanted to see our first sort of customer in the wild, so to speak.
Well, thank you very much for joining us.
Thanks for having me.
My guest has been Neil Blumenthal, co-founder of Warby Parker. Coming up, we'll meet Aya Badir, founder of Little Bits. I'm Jessica Harris. This is From Scratch. My guest is Aya Badir, founder of Little Bits, a hardware company that produces electronic modules that snap together with magnets. These electronic modules are accessible to both children and adults, and the company's goal is to encourage creativity and invention by making electronics easier to use. Little Bits was launched in 2011, and the kits are sold in more than 70 countries. Aya graduated with a degree in computer engineering from American University in Beirut and has a master's from the MIT Media Lab. Aya is also an interactive artist. Welcome.
Thank you. Thank you for having me.
You grew up in Lebanon. You were always encouraged down the engineering route. How come?
So I actually wanted to be a designer when I was in school, but I was very good at math and science. And so my family, my parents and my teachers told me that I owed it to myself to be an engineer. And I went into engineering because it was sort of the thing to do. But very quickly, I realized that engineering was very dry and very much not creative. And I felt like there was a big piece of my brain, like the creative portion, that was really not engaged. And so those were the seeds of some of the work that I ended up doing with Little Bits.
And also, you are an interactive artist, meaning that you are using technology in your art. Mm. And your focus is on perceptions of Arabian identity. One of your works is Arabia. Tell me about that.
So that was a project that came from a personal place. I had moved to the U.S. For a couple of years, and more frequently than I thought, I would get comments from people that say, "Oh, you're Arab. How come you're not wearing a veil? You're Arab. Are you able to belly dance?" And I would get these like very polarized cliches thrown at me all the time. And I'd never thought of these things when I was growing up. And so, Arabia was basically a piece that I developed for a fashion show. It's a belly dancing outfit, and you have the model, the dancer, comes out to the stage and performs this really beautiful, very sensual dance. And then at one point, she flips a switch on her outfit, and through motors, the outfit starts to close on itself and turns into a burqa, just showing these two extremes of stereotypes associated with Arab women.
You're using technology and electronics in your artwork. work playing with the two. And that's what you're encouraging people to do through little bits, basically, just to create and be inventive. What are some examples of some of the projects that the general public creates with Little Bic kits?
At the root, what we are doing, our mission is to put the power of electronics in everyone's hands and make anyone an inventor. We've been described as Lego for electronics or Lego for the 21st century. So they are bricks that instead of being plastic, are lights and sounds and sensors and motors. And with the same ease, you can start using them. Kids have used them to learn about electronics or to create line-following robots. They've created, yesterday we saw a kid who made a flute that makes soap bubbles as he's blowing into the flute through a fan and some sensors. Also things that, you know, there's a lot of energy and attention towards the Internet of Things now. And we do have, with Little Bits, this ability to attach the Internet to anything so that you can bring appliances or devices at home to life and make them controllable with your phone. So we've seen people, for example, make something like a remote pet feeder so that if you're at home at the office and your pet is hungry, you can, through your phone, press a button and have a little motor turn a cup of food for your pets so you can feed them remotely.
You, in 2008, came up with the idea or the early prototypes for Little Bits, but it wasn't until 2011 that you actually launched the company. And it was your boyfriend who encouraged you to kind of stop everything else that you were doing. What's the story there?
So in about April 2011, I had been working on Little Bits as a project, as one of my projects for a few years, and I had gone and found a factory to make it, and was doing prototypes. And in April 2011, I got the first shipment of a prototype from a factory that I'd been working with in China, and for the first time, I basically saw that Little Bits was manufacturable. And simultaneously, I'd been getting a good amount of press that was interested in the concept of kind of making electronics accessible to kids and adults. And so people would write in wanting to place orders. And so my boyfriend said, you have a product that's manufacturable and you have a customer that wants it. You need to stop everything else you're doing and start a company. And it was kind of like, oh, yeah, why not?
Is he still your boyfriend?
He's my husband now, yes.
Where did you meet him?
I met him in New York, actually. He co-curated a show with MoMA, with Paola Antonelli, called Design and the Elastic Mind, that was about design and science. He was chairing the conference, and I was giving a talk there.
In 2011, shortly after you launched, there was an exhibit at MoMA, or the Museum of Modern Art, where Little Bits was displayed, and Little Bits is now in the permanent collection. Can you tell me about that?
Sure. So there was an exhibit called Talk to Me by Paola Antonelli, who's the head design curator. And the exhibit was about the interaction between people and things. And Little Bits was on display in that exhibit. And it was a huge, huge honor because it was with some of the greatest design and technology pieces of the day. Shortly thereafter, they sent me an email saying that they wanted to acquire Little Bits into the permanent collection of the museum.
One of the germs for Little Bits was the creation of the concrete brick, which you've talked about before, invented in 1868. What is the connection of the concrete brick to your modules?
I believe that, you know, the world keeps changing and the technologies of the day are moving fast. And so in the early 1900s, the technology of the day was a concrete brick. That was the way we started to build larger, more complex structures, one brick at a time. And a little bit after, Lego came out with a play version of that brick in order to empower young and the young at heart to be able to play with that technology that was really ruling the world and be able to make buildings and bridges and these beautiful structures one brick at a time.
And they were called the automatic bonding brick?
Automatic bonding brick was the first name that they had. And now the world has changed again. Now the brick is no longer a cement brick. The brick is now a transistor, which is something that is driving all the technologies around us. The devices we carry, our phones, our alarm systems, they all at their node have a transistor. And so what is the play or the imagination version of that brick? How can we put that in the hands of the kids and kids at heart so that they can kind of understand the world and reinvent it? And that's sort of what drove a lot of the work on Little Bits.
What were a few pivot points for you for the company where you felt like you were getting traction from the public?
MoMA was definitely one. In September 2011, basically it was the day I launched the company, and at the same time we were acquired into the permanent collection. So it really kind of started us off on a really strong footing and with a lot of confidence and kind of a big stage to play on. And then in February 2012, I became a TED fellow and I gave a talk at TED, which was also a pivotal moment. It was really a chance to talk about why this is important and why this is important for society, not as a gadget or a toy. It's important as a new way of thinking.
I'm Jessica Harris. You're listening to From Scratch. My guest is Aya Bedir, founder of Little Bits, a company that sells electronic modules that snap together using magnets. These modules are generally easy to use, making them appealing to the general population, both adults and children. The company was started in 2011, and the kits are sold in more than 70 countries. Aya is also an interactive artist raised in Beirut, Lebanon.
You asked actually on pivotal moments. There is one more. Early on in the company, when we launched, we got an email from NASA, from the education department at NASA, saying that they wanted to collaborate with us to create kits to make space and Earth exploration more attractive to kids. And they came to us saying, you know, we need your help. And that was a huge moment. And we collaborated together to create a kit called the Space Kit, which replicates some, to a high degree of fidelity, some experiments that are happening at NASA that make this wonder around space and Earth more palatable and more understandable.
What's an example?
You know, in order to wake up astronauts in the space station, NASA sends wirelessly some music to play music as an alarm. And we have a little experiment where you have a microphone and you're playing music from your phone or an MP3 player, and you're transmitting this wirelessly through infrared to a speaker somewhere else.
Ironic that your family really pushed you hard to become an engineer and go down this route, and you did it resentfully as you really wanted to pursue your art, and now you're back where you started.
Absolutely.
With a twist.
Yeah, with a twist.
What does your mother make of this?
My mother has been a huge, huge influence and inspiration on me. When I was growing up, she was doing her master's when I was about 6 or 8. So I would come home and we would do homework together. And so even though I grew up in the Arab world, I never had any idea that there was sort of a different career choices that women and men made. And she's very supportive today as well.
You are part of the maker movement or the open hardware movement. Can you describe that?
The maker movement is really a movement that started around this idea that we should not be just consuming objects around us, that humans were made to be creative and to make with their hands. And that's how you learn. It's how you connect with friends. It's how you invent. And the maker movement is all about sort of making things for yourselves, whether it's arts and crafts, whether it's making electronics. It's really about putting the power back in the hands of the people instead of just the large companies. I do remember kind of early in the 2000s, you started to really see a world where everything was a screen and everything was virtual and every relationship was happening online. And for a lot of people, myself included, that's not a pretty world that I would like to live in. I believe in the tactile. I believe in feeling the satisfaction of having made something. And so what happened is I think that we realized that software in kind of the cloud or in virtual space, without it being on objects and in objects around us, becomes really intimidating and almost not human. And so now the pendulum swung back again to say, all of the things we learned from software, how can we now embed them into devices of all sizes and spaces that are around us?
You attended the iBeam Art and Tech Center in New York. How important was that in the evolution of Little Bits? And what is it?
iBeam is an art and technology lab and center in New York. That was a very, very, very pivotal moment in my life. I had done engineering, and then I went to the media lab at MIT and was doing sort of engineering and art and doing a lot of research around that subject. And then I graduated in 2006 and got a job in finance. And I did finance for 2 years, and I was very, very miserable. And I didn't want to be doing PowerPoints and meeting with hedge funds. And so I quit, and I got a fellowship at IBM. And at IBM, I picked up these ideas of incorporating electronic with arts. And then Little Bits was a second project, just to think about, you know, how do I put this ability to use electronics for creativity? How do I put this ability in the hands of other people, not just myself? Which is sort of the genesis of Little Bits.
In addition to selling these modules, the community aspect of Little Bits has really developed. You have something called a Maker Hub, where people are on your site sharing what they've made, as well as BitLab, which is basically an app store for hardware.
So on the first piece, the community, basically, you know, because Little Bits is essentially a system of these electronic bricks, you know, the point is not the bricks, the point is what you make with them. And so we have a space on the website where there are thousands of projects that people have uploaded with step-by-step tutorials for things you can make. You then have kids that are 8 years old and adults that are 45 years old collaborating on an idea.
What's an example?
We have one of our community members that made basically a surf weather alert because he wanted to know when it was a good tide to go surfing. And so basically connected this motor to make a display that's on a beach that reads from weather data to get like high tide, low tide, and basically creates these notifications that go back and forth and tell him now it's a good time to surf. And that's an example of a collaboration that was across different ages and experiences.
I want to talk about the design of the product. They're white circuit boards with very colorful connectors, pink and blue and green. Can you talk to me about some of those choices?
Electronics are always ugly. They're always green or black, and there's wires sticking out everywhere. And they're the thing you put inside something. You make a shell around it to cover them. And part of sort of the challenge was, how do you make electronics not intimidating? How do you make them inviting? And so one of the tools to cross that hurdle is to make them beautiful, make them exposed so they're open. They're not hidden under any box. They're white because it's less sort of scary. They have this handwritten font on them because it makes them feel human. And they have these neon-colored connectors because we want them to be gender-neutral. People gravitate towards them that never would have put their hand on electronics, whether it's kids, particularly young girls, but also entrepreneurs, designers, artists, people that have no engineering training whatsoever or no interest in engineering.
You mentioned gender-neutral. Neutrality. In what ways are you mindful of encouraging girls to pick up the product?
Getting more girls and women into technology is a hidden agenda of the company, but we don't wear it on our sleeve. What we do is make very, very deliberate choices to make sure that the product, the communication around the product, and everything the company stands for is egalitarian.
I want to talk about venture capital for a moment. You've raised a couple...
So fun.
You've raised a few rounds of venture capital. What have been your impressions of that process along the way?
Raising money is not easy in general. But in addition to that, raising money for a hardware company is difficult. I remember early on in one of my pitches, one investor, very, very prominent investor, told me, I love your business. I love everything you're doing. I think it's going to be a smashing success, but I can't invest in you. Your business is too much of a real business for us. There is the reality. There's physical product and raw material and shipping and taxes and warehouses. And, you know, the barrier to being successful is much higher than making a piece of software and getting a million people to use it. So the hardware component adds to the complexity of raising money. I don't actively think about it, but there is an extra stigma of being a woman.
What is one example?
I'd rather not proliferate the anecdotes, and instead I'll say what I learned and what I think is a proactive way to solve it. I think that the generation before us fought a very hard fight, and we stand on their shoulders for being able to do the things that we're able to do. But now we have a different fight to fight, which is do great work. And I think that the best way to succeed is something that actually Sarah Silverman said once in one of her shows, which is just be undeniable. Be undeniable. And then nobody can come in and say, but she's a woman. It will not happen. And then the third reason why it's difficult to raise money is I got a good piece of advice early on, which is not all money is equal. You can get money from anywhere, but getting the right kind of money or smart money is transformative.
Your modules allow you to do a whole array of things, of one of which most recently is to make music. And you have all these modules in front of me. Can you make some music for me?
Sure. So what I have is a power bit, which is blue, and I'm going to snap it into an oscillator, which is generating the sound wave, and a speaker. And now I'm tuning the oscillator. And then I can put a keyboard. Add a sequencer.
Thank you very much for joining us.
Thank you very much for having me.
My guest has been Aya Badir, founder of Little Bits. If you would like to learn more about the show, please visit our website at fromscratchradio.org. You can also follow us on Twitter at Jess G. Harris or find us on Facebook. I'm Jessica Harris. This is From Scratch.